Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to students and friends here and there across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, and I'm making this recording on Sunday, March 25th, 2012, from the flatlands of Flanders in Belgium. Right now it's around 4:30 in the afternoon. I'm looking out across the flat fields that lie in all directions here. Fields planted with various crops throughout the year. That may be corn, sugar beets, sometimes linen, which is very beautiful, produces a violet-colored flower, sometimes potatoes. It appears now that the fields have been planted with a grass-like crop that is going to be plowed under in preparation for the spring planting. Sky is impeccably clear right now, rather unusual. I sometimes wonder if the weather doesn't conform itself around me in a particular way at certain moments. One of the reasons why I wasn't able to stay here in Belgium was I wasn't able to see the sky as I needed to and as I so desired to over many years. I long to see the sky like one longs to see the face of a beloved person. So I found the ideal sky viewing platform down there in Spain. Down there as well, it's also been almost cloudless for most of the winter, and we're facing a serious threat of drought because there has been no rain, but the lack of rain and the impeccably blue azure skies of Andalusia has allowed me to track the astronomical features of correction in very fine detail and in granular detail, to be exact. So I guess you could say, in a sense, that the conditions of weather where the Turton abides have been ideal for Tertonic observations. Now the house where I am now is oriented exactly to the four cardinal points. So standing in the living room and looking out the big picture window, you look due west. Last night I was standing there and I saw the crescent moon, the first appearance of the sunset crescent on March 25th. Just above it was the planet Jupiter, a little bit to the left. Just above that, brighter and larger, was Venus. And just above Venus, a little bit to the right, was the unmistakable star cluster called the Pleiades, or the Seven Sisters. So you had a crescent moon aligned to Venus, Jupiter, Pleiades. I call this the omen of remembrance. And I'm also going to entitle this navigator briefing, number 4, as the omen of remembrance. This navigator briefing accompanies and succeeds crew note 17, which I sent out a couple of days ago. In crew note 17, you'll find a kind of chronological sequence, of some of the events that occur in Sophia's recapitulation. The timing of these events is constructed according to the transit of the lunar apogee through the constellations. As you all know, this is one of the basic methods that I use for tracking the course of correction. That particular set of crew note 17, entitled 2012 Recall, also contains a summary of the Jupiterian features of self-navigation that refers to the current omen in the sky. I noted that March 13th was the day when Jupiter and Venus were in exact longitudinal alignment. That is the moment when the omen kicked off, as it were. This is an omen that has a progressive aspect to it. It's extremely interesting in that respect. It's not just an omen that appears in the sky and in the signature of the celestial writing for one or two days, but it's something that is unfolding and reverberating, as it were, over a considerable period of time. So we are now following the omen of remembrance involving Venus, Jupiter, and the Pleiades in the western sky after sunset. And we are following it from March 13th onward through April and into around June 13th, when Jupiter itself stands close to, in close alignment, in exact alignment with the Seven Sisters or the Pleiades. So we're talking about an omen extending from March 13th to June 13th. That is 2 months long, and that is the duration of the omen of remembrance. But that is only the first part of a two-part omen. So this is really something extraordinary happening here. And I'd like to dedicate the bulk of this briefing to some general observations about naked eye astronomy, and specifically to the features of this magnificent omen we are witnessing. Right now, it's about still a couple of hours before the sun will go down, and I will be able to go outside then, stand in the road or stand in the field across the house, and look directly due west across the absolutely flat horizon. And there I will see the continuation of the spectacle that I saw last night. Last night I got the first glimpse of the crescent moon, and it was in the constellation of the Fishes. In fact, it stood exactly along the line of stars that defines the ascent of the eastern fish, the fish that is leaping upward from the ecliptic. I'll get back to that point in a moment because it concerns the matter of the double shift of Swan Deva. And I'd like to go into the meaning of that. A number of you have written me about it, asking what that means. I also know that a number of you in the Gaia navigation experiment may have some difficulty following the astronomical details. You may find them complicated or remote. And it's my intention by the end of this little talk to have made it all a bit more accessible and user-friendly for you. So I do wish to succeed. I have a strong desire to do that. You let me know if I've succeeded. But before I get to the specific concept of the Dakini shifts, just want to point out the progression that you'll be seeing over the next few days. Now, a number of you have written me the progression of the crescent moon. A number of you have written me expressing your distress and exasperation that you can't see the sky, you can't see the evening sky, you can't observe these things because it's too cloudy and overcast, or maybe chemtrailed, if you believe that internet myth. In the area where you are observing. So I just want to point out that we can rely on our conic technology to make up for these conditions. Do not become dependent solely on our conic technology, but we can rely on it to help in this fantastic experiment of imagination and observation that we have undertaken. So I advise you to download stellarium.org. It's very easy to use this program. And once you set it up for your location, every time you bring it up, it will show you exactly how the sky looks. I'm looking at Stellarium right now for March 25th, 2012. And what I see looking west toward the western horizon is that the sun, I've advanced it a couple of hours to the moment when the sun goes down. What I then see is what any of you can see if you use Stellarium, and I advise that you do so. I especially advise that those of you in the Gaia navigation experiment who have trouble following the astronomy and may not have adequate viewing conditions, do this. Download Stellarium. It's a very easy program to handle. And bring it around to the western horizon, set it for March 25th at sunset, and watch what I'm going to describe now. Now, what I'm going to describe from my point of view may not be exactly what you would get on your stellarium, say in California, because you're 9 hours later than me. So the moon, 9 hours later than here, would have advanced further toward Jupiter and Venus than it is currently from my view. So we do have a certain differential in observation at different locales on the Earth. For instance, when I observed the first young crescent moon last night, it was still in the constellation of Pisces, just barely. But that told me that we would have a second shift of Swan-Deva, who is the diamond sky Dakini connected, correlated to the constellation of Pisces, or the fishes, the whales. But if you had observed the same moment, the same sunset event, 9 hours later in California, well, in 9 hours, the moon moves almost 5 degrees. So you would have observed that the crescent moon, upon its first sighting, was in the constellation of the Ram. And you would put the shift to Chinnamasta, who is the Mahavidya, correlated to the constellation of the Ram. So you see, these are the differences that we learn as we enter this practice. And it is flexible. This is not an absolutely rigid practice. It depends on the depth of our participation, how we experience these things. As I've said before, when questions were raised about calling the Dakini shift, it is possible that people in one part of the world could receive the shift through one Dakini and people elsewhere in the world could receive it through another. That is possible. I really don't know, because I've only been doing this myself for about 3 years now, 4 years actually. And those of you who are undertaking it with me now, crew members of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, are actually in the avant-garde of a fantastic experience in participation with the cosmos and with the life and soul and designs and purposes of the Wisdom Goddess herself. And there is much to be learned here. I do not lay down planetary tantra in the form of rigid laws and formulas. I can just say that as the Turton, who is the and scepter of this process, that I call the current shift Swan-Deva due to my observation. And the fact that you in California would only perceive the crescent when it has advanced into the Ram does not necessarily mean that you in California would observe the cycle of Chinnamasta rather than Swan-Deva. What I'm saying now in this instance is that I'm calling this shift for Swan-Deva because the first appearance determines the shift. And I had an earlier appearance here in Europe than you would have had in the United States or in any point westward across the Atlantic. So you can say I'm in a privileged position to call a shift under these conditions, but these conditions are not absolute. The system of the lunar cycles determined by the constellations is flexible and cannot be programmatically and strictly predicted, which is a good thing. When we live in real time with the moods and frequencies of the Earth, the moods and attitudes of the living planet, we roll with those frequencies and attitudes. We dance with them, and we do not pin them down to some kind of rigid male mastermind schema, because that is inconsistent with the nature of the experience. So getting back to the view from Stellarium, if you have it in front of you as you're listening to this talk, you'll see that there is the satanic head of Cetus formed by the five stars, a pentagram of stars. And Stellarium has the feature that you can use the constellational art. So if you want to click constellational art, you see that that corresponds to the head of a sea monster. You'll see the figure of the ram and the figure of the fish that leaps toward Andromeda. So today, the first evening after the first sighting of the crescent of this cycle, the moon has advanced. And there's a pattern of advance here. On this day, the 25th, the crescent moon appears close to Jupiter. If you advance it one day to the 26th, it appears close to Venus. And you have advanced it one day more, 27th, and it appears just slightly beyond the Pleiades, which are off to the right. And so, in fact, the notable spectacle of the crescent moon is actually making a journey, a kind of relay race, through this magnificent display of two planets and the open star cluster called the Pleiades. And it is making a pit stop at each one of these three points before it goes on and proceeds to move through the constellation of the Bull and then close to the star Antares, through the horns of the Bull, as you can see, and into the Twins and so forth. So you can track this very closely on Stellarium. And if you can't see it in the sky, well, use Stellarium so that you can picture it in your mind and then visualize it. And the visualization of it will be a second best to the actual observation. So you can continue to do the practice without being exasperated. Now, before I get into the details of the omen of remembrance denoted by the Venus and Jupiter interactions in the area of the Pleiades, let's see if I can clarify the matter of the lunar cycles or lunar shaktis, or to make it even more clear than I have already. Occasionally a crew member writes in saying they can't follow this, they don't know what it means, what it's supposed to signify. So here is my explanation of what it signifies in a general sense. We can all understand that ancient peoples and indigenous peoples lived in harmony with the cycles of nature, you could say. Whether the moments, all their moments and interactions with nature were harmonious, that's arguable. Some of them may have been moments of conflict or difficulty because nature can be adversarial. But in terms of the rhythm of the seasons, people have lived on this earth in natural response and coordination with the seasons and the cycles of the seasons for countless, countless thousands and thousands of years. It's only when calendars are invented, which are an archonic device to organize society along certain predictable lines, that we get an overwrite. The human mind, the brain with its NLP programming, gets overwritten by calendars. And then people no longer observe the sky, they no longer observe the phase of the moon or the seasons. They tend to just look at an archonic device, such as a calendar, which is hanging on the refrigerator, and that tells them, for instance, that it's Sunday, March 23rd, and who knows what season it is, but you might observe that the spring equinox occurred a couple of days ago. But could you have known that the spring equinox occurred a couple of days ago had you not had the calendar to tell you, had you had not had the archonic device to inform you of that? Well, certainly you could. And if you would like to learn how to do that, just follow this experiment. Ancient peoples knew when the equinoxes and solstices were going to occur. They anticipated and celebrated those moments, as well as the cross-quarter days, which are the days 45, the moments 45 days in between the three-month intervals between the solstices and the equinoxes. For instance, February 2nd, or the Imbolc in Celtic culture, is the Feast of Candles, or Candlemas, and that is a point, a moment, exactly halfway between the winter solstice and the spring equinox. So all of these eight moments of the year were routinely observed, and people were able to anticipate these moments, anticipate the seasons, and put themselves and put their behavior and even their attitude in harmony with the cycles of nature. Well, we're doing the same thing in the Gaia navigation experiment, but we're doing it, I'm proposing that we do it, at another level. We're not merely putting ourselves in sync with the cycles of the seasons, with the natural cycles, we are putting ourselves in sync with the supernatural cycles of the year. And the supernatural cycles of the year are not so much the changes in nature that produce spring with its blossoming and leafing of trees, the rising of the sap that produce summer with the flowering of plants and fruits, that produce autumn with the harvesting and the dying away of fruits and plants, the descent of the sap that produce the winter with the dormancy of the plant world and so forth. We are following those seasons, obviously, but in another dimension, we are following something else. We are following the moods of the living being who is the earth, the moods of Gaia, her moods, her attitudes, her thoughts even. You see, her thoughts follow a certain kind of sequence comparable to, and in some respects you could say parallel to, the cycle of the seasons. The mind of Gaia, the mind of the divine Sophia, who is embodied in this planet, operates on a cycle of frequencies that continually repeat themselves, but each time repeat themselves in a unique and original way. Each, just as no single spring is the same, no single shift of Swandeva is the same. The shifts of Swandeva occur in the spring routinely. But the diversity of the moods of the planet and the novelty and originality and innovation that occur in her psychic moods and in her inner thoughts far exceeds the diversity that we see in nature, or is in certain respects a mirror of that diversity, but even with amplifications. So we are actually entering into a practice of a kind of telepathy, a kind of empathic participation via telepathy with the moods and thoughts and attitudes of Gaia. This is what we do in following these shifts month by month throughout the year. The wonderful tool of planetary tantra allows us to do this by presenting the correlation of the 13 constellations on the path of the sun, moon, and the earth to certain frequencies of the wisdom goddess. And these frequencies are called variously Mahavidyas or Diamond Sky Dakinis. And there are 10 Mahavidyas, although one of them does not broadcast on any of these frequencies. That's Dumavati. And there are 5 Diamond Sky Dakinis. So all in all, there are 9 and 14, 9 and 5, or 14 divine feminine modalities that are reflected in and transmitted through the lunar cycles month by month. So what happens in this practice, which is essential to planetary tantra, is a process of attunement and a process of recognition. Because I am able to characterize and profile something about these modalities, I can tell you something about what is going to be broadcast on those stations when the moment comes around for those stations to be transmitting. There are, in fact, Gaia Sophia transmits to us on these 16 different stations, 14 of which are cyclically reflected month by month in the passage of the moon through the constellations. So this is what the practice consists of. If that is clear, I'd be very happy to know that I succeeded in getting that across. Now, just one more technicality before I come to the current shift and explain to you what it means by what I mean by a double shift. The new moon occurs each month around 29 days. Every 29 days there is a new moon, and at that time the moon passes between the Earth and the Sun. The moon, which is orbiting around the Earth, passes between the Earth and the Sun and becomes non-observable for about 2 days. As soon as the moon begins to move out from this hidden position, it appears as a thin crescent in the western sky after sunset. This is called the sunset crescent. Now that crescent appears actually somewhere against the background of the distant constellations, of which there are 13. And so, by observation of that early crescent, that sunset crescent, and detection of its placement in the constellations, we read which modality of the Gaian planetary intelligence is broadcasting for that 29-day period of time. This is called the shift, which may be a shift of one of the five diamond sky Dakinis or one of the nine Mahavidyas in the Shakti cluster. And you can find all this outlined, not completely adequately or thoroughly, but outlined to some degree in Planetary Tantra under the category of lunar Shaktis. So, final point that I need to explain is something that you yourself can observe if you look at the current situation on Stellarium for March 24th or 25th or 26th, looking toward the western horizon just after sunset. You can observe that there is the constellation of Pisces or the whales descending because the sun is in the fishes or the whales. And you observe that that constellation is a large elongated V. One of the arms of the V stretches along the ecliptic or the path of the sun, that is the westward swimming fish. Another arm of the V points upward and actually points exactly and directly to the Andromeda Galaxy. It's a remarkable feature. If you look at it on Stellarium, you'll see that there is a point formed, a triangular point formed by the constellation. And if you look to where that's pointing, it points exactly to M31, the Andromeda Galaxy. Exactly. Or exactly, I should say. So, fascinating and fantastic detail there. And at the moment last night when I observed the lunar crescent, it was aligned to that pointer. And so it was aligned in turn to the M31 Andromeda Galaxy. But what I want you to notice, looking at Stellarium, is the extent of the constellation of the fishes. These constellations, which comprise the 13 star formations of the real sky zodiac, are not consistent or uniform in shape or in extent. Now, consider this simple fact. Each month, each 29 days, each lunar month, the new moon occurs about 30 degrees in advance of where it occurred the previous month. So there are uniform 30-degree jumps, as it were, made by the new moon through the course of the year. However, the distribution of these real sky star patterns, the zodiacal constellations, does not fall into uniform 30-degree sections. You can clearly see the contrast between the extent of the constellation of Pisces, which is somewhat between almost 40 degrees, over 40 degrees in extent, compared to the next constellation there of the Ram, which is half that size, only 20 degrees in extent. So, it follows that the new moon, as it makes these 30-degree jumps going around the zodiac, is not going to fall uniformly in one constellation after the other. It's not just going to fall in the fishes, and then in the ram, and then in the bull, and then in the twins. Absolutely consistently. There is a certain consistency, of course. You can count on it falling in the fishes in the early spring, You can count on it falling in the Bull, which is also a large constellation, later in the spring. But you cannot program or predict exactly how this will happen year by year. It's just not possible to do that. You have to be present in real time with the process to know what the process is doing. And that's one of the beautiful things about this practice, as many of you have observed. So I would say that the key to getting into this practice, for those of you who feel left out or maybe baffled and intimidated by the astronomical material, the key is the willingness to be present at a particular designated moment. The willingness to be present and to either observe the sky at that moment, if you have the opportunity, or to visualize what is happening in the sky. That is what will get you into this experiment. That is what is going to make you feel comfortable in this practice. It's not mastering a vast amount of detail about astronomy or other fine points of celestial observation. It's just the willingness to be present at these moments, and it's my job as a navigator to tell you when these moments happen. So I was present yesterday, Saturday evening, March 24th, knowing that I would very likely get to view the faint early crescent in the west, looking across the absolutely flat horizon of Flanders in Belgium. If I had been somewhere else where there was a mountain to the west, I would not have been able to see the early crescent because it could have been hidden behind the mountain, you see. So there are all kinds of conditions of observation to be factored into this. So I determined that the crescent moon last night stood in the constellation of the Fishes. But if you go back 29 degrees previously to the previous observation, it also stood in the constellation of the Fishes. How is that possible? Well, look at the constellation of the Fishes. It is so large that if the crescent appears at the head of the western fish, the one that is moving along the path of the sun, at the one cycle, then 29 days later, it can occur again in the same constellation. Consequently, we can predict that it will skip the constellation of the Ram, because the constellation of the Ram is only 20 degrees long. So one can conclude from these facts that on the occasion of the next new moon, the lunar crescent will not appear in the constellation of the Ram. One can actually predict this, and if you want to cheat a little, you can use stellarium to confirm this. Jump stellarium up till around the date of April 22nd or 23rd. You will see the crescent moon emerging from the halo of the sun, but it very rapidly passes through the narrow extent of the constellation of the Ram. And so when it initially becomes visible on the 23rd of April, it's in the constellation of the Bull. And that tells us that the lunar shift of that time, the lunar shift commencing at that time, comes under the dual rulership of Bhudevi or Bhuvaneshvari and the wrathful green Tara. New moons, sunset crescents that appear in the Bull indicate an extraordinary situation in which two Mahavidyas are on shift during that period. That's an exceptional situation which you don't find anywhere else around the cycle of the zodiac. So there you have it. Now you know why I am speaking of a second shift of Swan Deva. The previous shift, which began at the end of February, was signaled by the appearance of the sunset crescent around the 23rd and 24th of February in the Fishes. and the following sunset crescent of yesterday also in the fishes. So this is a rare instance of a springtime in 2012 when we have two shifts under the diamond sky Dakini known as Swan Deva. Now, what does this mean? Well, basically it means that there will be a continuation, amplification, and escalation, not to mention intensification, of the mood and attitude and feeling and instructions of that particular Dakini that began already a month ago. The lessons streaming from that Dakini into your subliminal mind, or out of your subliminal mind, however you want to look at it, continue now for another month until around the 22nd of April. This is a magnificent opportunity to get to know these frequencies because we have, in effect, a two-month lesson as opposed to the normal one-month lesson. What are some of the indications of a shift under Swan Deva? How would I profile that Dakini and her instructions? Well, I have a lot to say about that right now, a lot to say. I must emphasize that I consider it highly auspicious that we are having a second shift of Swan Deva. And the reason for that is very specific. I've mentioned before that the instructions or teachings that proceed from these active subliminal modalities of the Gayan mind are expressed in Dakini syntax, which is a cogent language. When you hear, when you pick up, when you detect, or as I say, transceive, the instructions coming from Sophia herself, month by month, you detect them in a brief and cogent syntax. I have recorded some examples of this syntax in my Chronicle of the Lunar Shaktis in the Planetary Tantra section of metahistory.org. I do not have a complete list of Dakini instruction received from all months of the year, but I have an almost complete list. It's kind of in chaotic order. It needs to be organized better. I'm getting to that one of these days. But for now, I'll just point out that among all of the nine Mahavidyas and the five Diamond Sky Dakinis who transmit in these monthly cycles, Swan Deva is unique. Swan Deva is the only modality of the Sophianic mind speaking to us that uses a long narrative form. She's called, for that reason, the story keeper or the dream keeper, because she preserves the long plot factors in the story of our species and of our wisdom goddess, who is the earth. Swan Deva's instruction comes in the form of a memory that unfolds in your own mind, a coherent and cohesive memory at the level of phylogenetic existence, a memory of the species. She is profoundly connected, of course, with the Andromedan doubles on M31, the Andromedan galaxy. Recall that in the Gaian mythology we're developing, it is our Andromedan doubles who preserve a clear and coherent memory of the true history of this Earth, whereas we ourselves, as Earthbound counterparts to them, suffer from a break of continuity, which is a terrible problem for the divine Sophia, by the way, a break of continuity, forgetfulness, amnesia, and oblivion. And so there are vast parts of our story as a species that we don't remember. The reasons for this are very fascinating, and I intend to look into them closely during the fantastic opportunity we're now facing, that is to say, to undergo a second shift of Swan Deva. But additional to this unique property of Swan Deva, namely that she deals in long narrative sequences rather than cogent and enigmatic phrases. Additional to that, I would just point out some of the qualities or moods or impressions that you will have during a Swan Deva shift. Some of you have written into me already presenting your observations in this respect. And amazingly, when crew members write to the nav and they report their observations, their inner observations and self-observations regarding what they feel, what they sense at the beginning of a Dakini shift, because it's always at the beginning of a Dakini shift that these impressions are the strongest, although they do prevail through an entire shift. When crew members do this, I have to tell you, it's fantastic for me, because what they report from their own experience is almost 100% consistent. 90 or better, which is absolutely remarkable, which shows me that this process is voracious and objective. That just as animals and birds can sense the mood of Gaia in her seasonal cycles, we, the species of her genius project, the animal of her genius project, can sense her subjective moods and the thoughts and attitudes that she herself develops in the depths of her own soul, which is the anima mundi, or the soul of the world, the anima mundi. We are tuning in to the frequencies and colors and themes of the anima mundi. This is the practice of observing the lunar shaktis. Some of the impressions reported, which I can confirm myself for Swandeva, are a lofty feeling, a feeling of floating and yet being very embodied, a feeling of a magnificence, of an expansion in one's chest, a feeling of expansion of emotion, that there is something grandiose and beautiful unfolding in one's emotional life. A sense of inner serenity, of poise, a sense of great, a lyrical feeling. The feeling of Swandeva is highly lyrical. Of course, we could associate these feelings with the onslaught of spring. And there is a close correlation between the natural cycles and the supernatural cycles. And this is something that can be observed and objectively verified by different witnesses. I would also note, and I'll pick up on this a little bit more in the second, in the following briefing, number 5, you can also observe that during the Swandeva shift, when you are actually being handled by this Dakini, during this shift, the Dakini frequencies, which emanate from the earth itself, from the living intelligence and emotional body of the earth, are permeating you at a cellular level. And it is fantastic that you can be provided by the tools that will enable you to detect what is being done to you and how you are being led and guided and permeated by these sublime frequencies rooted in the earth itself. That is the art of planetary tantra, using tools which allow you to monitor your own processes interactive with the earth. It's kind of like a biofeedback. We are, as human animals, in an extremely profound biofeedback loop with the earth mother. And we can know from moment to moment and month to month how she is nurturing her own purposes and vision in our souls by following these cycles. It is an absolutely magnificent process, and it's easy. It's something that happens naturally. It cannot be forced, cannot be fabricated. I'm not talking about magical thinking here, folks. How many times do I have to repeat that? To do magical thinking or to practice the kind of new age make-believe that they recommend under such programs as The Secret, you have to make an effort. You have to will yourself into some kind of mindset, believing that by putting yourself into that mindset, you will manifest something out of that mindset. This process is not like that at all. She puts you in the mindset. Or you could say as well, she puts the mindset in you. And all you have to do is detect how she does so. And you do it effortlessly. You do it by allowing your mind to flow, allowing your feelings to vibrate toward the earth and come back from the earth. And in the formation and configuration of your emotions and your moods and your attitudes, the revelation of these sublime forces becomes self-evident. And so one of the things that one typically feels in the presence of Swandeva is a sense of the expansion of your mind, so that you are suddenly able to grasp with your mind vast vistas, whole sections of thought or sections of visualization extending very, very far in time and space or through history, that ordinarily it would be difficult for you to comprehend these things. So you see, the role of Swandeva is very, very special in that she assists us in this faculty of recall. And right now, during the 3 years of correction, when Sophia herself is undergoing a massive process of recapitulation, the shifts of Swandeva have a particularly crucial bearing, both for the wisdom goddess and for us. And I intend to show how in the next few months we move into a recapitulation process of our entire species. We begin to remember the story of our species at the moment that she remembers the conditions in which she set up the experiment for our species. And this is a unique event that happens only once around the year and a half point, going into the second year and into the year and a half point of correction. That is from the spring of 2012 into the fall. And I can plot exactly the key moments when this recall process will surge. And by giving you those moments to anticipate, you yourselves become witnesses to the Nahual, witnesses to the supernatural beauty of Gaia's awakening, witnesses to the magnificent narrative that is the true story of our species. And you are weavers and witnesses in that story. You are participants in that story, creating the plot of the story with the wisdom goddess. This is the opportunity that comes to humanity in the second year of correction, and it's dawning right now. In fact, I can read the omen of remembrance as the signal that the moment has come for the great remembering. The great remembering of how we emerged on this earth, how humanity really emerged, how it was that the female species, the female of the species, the female gender, was originally the only inhabitants of the earth. There existed no males on the earth at first. And that these primordial women, the Gaian women, were formed in a tuberous plant-like fashion from tubers that drifted up out of the sea. Life began in the sea, and these tuberous forms washed up out of the sea onto the beaches and shores of the world and metamorphosed into tuberous plants. And from those tuberous plants came the first bodies of women, which in turn developed into other plants and trees. And this is the race of arboreal nymphs, who were the first human inhabitants of this planet before the men came, which was a separate part of the story to be remembered a bit later on. So this is the true story of human existence on this planet. Or let me just not make that arrogant assumption. Let me just say to you that you can go read 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, as many as you want, versions of human evolution that explain to you how humanity, the human species, took form on this planet, how it assumed its current anatomical features. You can read the Darwinian, so-called alleged Darwinian theory of our descent from, or ascent from monkeys. You can read any number of other scenarios. You can read the what the Pleiadians, the people who are channeling the Pleiadians say. You can study what the people who are channeling the Lyrans say, and on and on. You can read the description of the generation of the human race in The Secret Doctrine by Madame Blavatsky. Go ahead. Go ahead. Anywhere you want. What I say to you is the version that we ourselves are now going to remember. We are cued to remember, poised to remember. That version, I may not claim to you arrogantly that is the sole true version, but I'll tell you something better. It is the only version that you can develop within the framework of her story in accordance with the overall plot of her story. There is only one explanation of the division of the sexes, of the first appearance of women on this earth, of the later arrival of man from the Orion Nebula. There is only one version of that story, because there is only one version of human genesis, anthropogenesis, that fits within her story. All of the other versions don't fit in her story. Now, you may consider them to be true, and the version that fits in her story to not be true, and that's fine with me. I won't argue with you. But I will emphasize to you one inarguable point, and that is the scenario of anthropogenesis that is erupting under the omen of remembrance is the only one that truthfully and voraciously fits inside her story, inside the Sophianic vision story. And so if you choose to observe that story, if you choose to follow the myth and be guided by the myth, not by me, not by any human authority, not by any book that was ever written down, be guided by this myth, and within that guidance, the remembrance. This is happening now. This is beginning. From the moment when Venus and Jupiter are exactly aligned on March 13th until June 13th, when Jupiter reaches the Pleiades, the spindle or astral stem in this galactic arm. This omen is unfolding in its first phase, and my role as a navigator is to give you the parameters to track it in real time, day after day, through the coming period right ahead of us. Now, if you would go back to Stellarium, set it up for the 24th of March, 25th of March, which is today, and then just press the plus key. And as you press the plus key, looking again at the vista of the head of Cetus, the constellation of the bull, the ram, in front of the head of Cetus, Jupiter and Venus between the stars forming the ram and the head of Cetus, the constellation of the whales descending. Look at that vista and press the plus key. And it shows you what happens day after day. Well, on the 26th, the crescent moon passes Venus. On the 27th, it passes Jupiter, passes the Pleiades, excuse me. But look at what Venus is doing. Press the key until you come to the 3rd of April. There you will see that Jupiter, which stands very closely on the line of the ecliptic, that's that yellowish line, that's the orbital plane of the Earth, is still eyeballing Cetus like crazy. But what has Venus done? Venus has advanced from her conference with Jupiter directly ahead, and she stands in the Pleiades on April 3rd, in the Pleiades, probably occultating some of the stars of the Pleiades. I call this the visitation of Venus in the chamber of the seven sisters, or the Hetaera. Hetaera, H-E-T-A-I-R-A. Remember that word. This is a word to learn as the omen of remembrance unfolds. Venus had a conference with Jupiter. What was that conference about? The syntax that I received on the terrace of my house in Andalusia was exactly this. Venus is pleasure and Jupiter is guidance. What happens when Venus and Jupiter meet and converse? They have a discussion that goes back and forth. The discussion concerns the pleasure of guidance and the guidance of pleasure. This discussion commences the great omen of remembrance. Let's look at the two parts of that Dakini syntax. What is the pleasure of guidance? Well, that's what I've been talking about in this whole talk, and that's what I talk about a lot. We all need to be guided. One of the great problems of humanity, not only of the individual, but of cultures and nations and civilizations, is how are they to be guided? Well, in planetary tantra, we've got a whole new option going here, folks. You are not guided by a book. You are not guided by a master. You are not guided by a doctrine. You are not guided by any authority of any kind. You have the pleasure of being guided by her story. The story is our guidance, and the Terma of Gaia Awakening is the tool to receive that guidance. So, one part of their conversation, which began on March 13th, was about the pleasure of guidance. I have the pleasure of guidance. I live in it all the time. The Sophianic vision story guides my life, and it is a pleasure in how it does so. In addition to that, their conversation had another aspect. You can say that Jupiter, representing the great teacher, guru, or hierophant, discoursed to Venus on the pleasure of guidance, as I have been discoursing to you today in this recording. Venus, in turn, discoursed to Jupiter on the guidance of pleasure. What is the guidance of pleasure? The guidance of pleasure is Kala Tantra. The pleasure of guidance is Planetary Tantra. Those of you who are following my talks, in the spring of 2012, I ask you to mark in your memories a most significant development. In my talks with Thomas Malone on Grok the Talk, you encountered me on several occasions, caught in the rush of the second attention. And I explained to everyone who would care to listen that it became imperative to me under the beginning of this omen. I can tell you now, at the beginning of this omen, it became imperative to me to start talking about planetary tantra and Kala Tantra at the same time. Kala Tantra is the Venusian element. Planetary Tantra, or the Terma of Gaia Awakening, is the Jupiterian element. They are both contained, in fact, in the Terma of Gaia Awakening. Planetary Tantra and Kala Tantra are both contained. But what is the unique mark of Kala Tantra? The guidance of pleasure. What does it mean, the guidance of pleasure? Well, it is a double entendre. First of all, it means to be guided by pleasure. I enjoy the guidance of pleasure. I, John Lash, enjoy the guidance of pleasure. That means that I allow my life, my morality, my lifestyle, my way of treating people, my way of treating myself, to be guided by pleasure. I do what is pleasurable, and I do it for the mere pleasure of doing it, if you will, for the sheer pleasure of doing it. There is another overtone to this syntax. The guidance of pleasure means that I am guided by pleasure. And that, as I just said, but also that I guide pleasure. The guidance of pleasure is like the guidance of a boat. I guide the boat. I steer by pleasure but simultaneously I steer pleasure. This is the art of Kala Tantra. You follow pleasure, but you do not follow it in a slavish or narcissistic manner. You follow it as a high discipline. You manage and you master the art of pleasure as a form of guidance that elevates you ethically, morally, physically, and in the hygiene of enlightenment, in the hygiene of body, mind, and spirit. This is the guidance of pleasure. So bear in mind that syntax and carry it over to the next talk, NAV briefing number 5, which I'm doing this evening again, just in these precious moments of late afternoon in anticipation of my view of the omen of remembrance, the guidance of pleasure, Venus, and the pleasure of guidance, Jupiter. And in the next talk, I take the opportunity to explain further how this omen develops and how it guides us, the witnesses to the Nahual, how it guides us in our participation in the correction of the Aeon Sophia in this momentous year of 2012.